For those of you who haven't met me before, I'm Hal Wolf. I'm a retired ALC-LCA pastor with a few other mixtures here in between, having taught in Presbyterian and other seminaries besides. So my interest in the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Eastern churches in general goes way back to seminary days, back in 35 or so. We've covered two things so far. We dealt with worship as the family of God, and we dealt a little bit yesterday with the whole business of infant communion, which is an issue now in the LCA and the ALC, but it's never been an issue in the Eastern Church. This series that I'm giving three out of six that I gave in Cyprus the early part of August at an ecumenical seminar there, and where we had a number of people from various denominations, and so we're trying to deal a little bit with the first three. The other three lectures I may or may not get around to doing some in the next 2 weeks while I'm still here. My interest in foot washing goes back to 1937 in Knox County, Ohio, where my nearest ecumenical neighbor was Pastor Zunkel, who was pastor of the Brethren Church. At that time, everybody called them the Dunkards. So Zunkel and I did a lot of ecumenical stuff together with adult classes together. We never got around to having a Lutheran Dunkard foot washing service. But I was always startled by the fact that here was a group of people who had the foot washing service. And I didn't know until 1940 and then later on in trips to the far Near East about how much it meant to the Eastern Orthodox and how much our people who struggle with New Testament theology and New Testament commentaries have difficulty. In fact, if you were at the Bible study this morning, most of us Lutherans, when it comes to the Gospel of John and the Lord's Supper, have to become docetists. We get to be all kinds of seeming so's, spiritualizing things, acting as if maybe the Lord's Supper is covered in the feeding of the 5,000 and chapter 6 with all the I am the living bread bit. You may not realize, or you've forgotten, that the Gospel of John has a longer upper room story than any of the other three Gospels. But it doesn't have anything about the Last Supper or Communion. So many people wonder, how did that ever happen? Now there are all kinds of possibilities about that, and we'll get into that in a moment. I'd like to reread something from Robert McAfee Brown, because we're going to be dealing with the Bible a bit differently than you've ever dealt with it before, especially chapter 13 of the Gospel of John, which is where part of the upper room story is told and where all the sacramental signs that Lutherans have always taught are involved in foot washing, and all the sacramental signs that Roman Catholics talked about are involved. Let me read again Robert McAfee Brown, because when we read the Bible, when we read theology, we often read with our own filters, with blinders. We aren't really open-minded when we read. We need to read open-mindedly and then make some decisions, rather than saying, well, I won't read that, or as I read that, I'm so damn mad I'm not going to listen to it, or something of the sort. So listen to it again, and what in the middle of this is said about certain people is specifically true Lutherans, Roman Catholics, and Western Protestants, with chapter 13 and chapter 6 of the Gospel of John. We read what we can bear to read, we hear what is tolerable to hear, and we evade or spiritualize those parts that leave us uncomfortable, if not outraged. And so we spiritualize the feeding of the 5,000, we spiritualize the I am the living bread from heaven. We spiritualize the foot washing, even when I ask somebody, what does the bronze statue on our altar stand for? It stands for humble servanthood, which is a nice thing for it to stand for, but the guy's got a basin in one hand and a towel draped over the other arm. And so we've spiritualized the foot washing when it was meant to be a sacrament. Let's just talk about a few things. First of all, let's deal with a bunch of stuff I put up here. We Lutherans like to say a sacrament, and the Catholics sort of agree with us. A sacrament has three elements. It has an earthly means or an earthly material, bestowing a spiritual or heavenly blessing commanded by Christ. That's sort of the general thing. There are all kinds of refinements and language on that. And so Lutherans and Catholics generally agree about a definition. Practically assigning that, Lutherans and Roman Catholics and other churches don't always agree. So we have maybe two sacraments usually in the Lutheran Church. We usually talk about baptism and the Last Supper, or the Lord's Supper, or Holy Communion, or Holy Eucharist, or you name it, the Lord's table, altar, table of the altar, or the sacrament of the altar, all kinds of, or just Thanksgiving, which is the translation of the Greek Eucharist. And then Luther had, at times in his life, suggested there ought to be two others. In the Bible study this morning, you heard Jim talk about the fact that Holden is using the confessional service a little bit more. Luther never gave up confession as a sacrament. The Lutheran Church gave it up, but Luther never did. And Luther at one other time, and he often talked off the top of his head, or to use a Western phrase, he shot from the hip at times, Luther also said there was a fourth sacrament. The fourth sacrament to Luther is one that isn't even up on the board in my listings, and that's simply the conversation of believers, which is really the third article kind of thing. I believe in the Holy Christian Church, the communion of saints, the communion, the conversation of believers. What you did each night with Arnie Mickelson, what you do with the afternoon seminars, what we did yesterday on how old is old, that to Luther was a sacramental act yesterday afternoon, because it was a conversation of believers about themselves and about their nature and about God. It had the earthly means, it had the spiritual blessing, and it was commanded by Christ to be in fellowship one with another. Now, I just said something about sacraments, and I have to do it. Those of you who've forgotten what the sacraments are in the Catholic Church, baptism, Eucharist, confession and penance, marriage, ordination, confirmation, and then what is now called anointing of the sick. The old-fashioned name was extreme unction or last rites. I added up here. Now, there are many sacramentals, like rosaries, like lighting candles, like other things that are around, like novenas, all kinds of things in other Catholic churches. And there are many things like that in other churches, including ours. I listed a few of them up here. The chrismation, which I mentioned, which can be done at our baptism with the sign of the cross with oil, or on Ash Wednesday, the sign of the cross in ashes. That's a use of a sacramental in many of our languages, or maybe we like to call it a rite. In addition, there's the icon painting. Icon painting is not an art form. Icon painting is a mystery. It must be done in certain ways, in certain styles, by certain styles of people, and they must have certain prayers before, during, and after the painting. And if an icon is sold to other than a church that's going to use it in its building, it is no longer an icon. In other words, it is no longer an earthly means conveying a divine blessing. So people who go to Greece and they buy an icon in a tourist shop, they haven't. They haven't bought an icon. They've bought a tourist equivalent of an icon. Foot washing is another sacramental, or maybe a sacrament. Sensing, monastic prayers, even the celibacy of the person up on the Mount Patmos, the Agape Feast, and you list a number of others. Now, the interesting thing about what I've just done is I've talked Western all the way, even though I put some Eastern stuff on the list. I've talked Western because the word sacrament and sacramentals is never used in the Near Eastern churches, in the Eastern Orthodox or the non-Chalcedonian. That's the other group of Eastern churches that were sort of called out of order in the 6th century by some of the other churches. They use the word, and I've got it over here, mysteries. And they usually don't try to define it. See, that's another interesting thing about the Eastern churches. We, ALC, LCA, and especially Missouri and Wisconsin, we like to define things down to the smallest dotting of an I and crossing of a T. We like to have every syllable of the Bible interpreted once and for all, and it can never be changed. We like to say the Book of Concord or something of that is unalterable. Some people talk about the Augsburg Confession. The one is the unalterable Augsburg Confession, unaltered, and one that was slightly changed a little bit later by Melanchthon, and as if that was some kind of heresy to change what had once been written by Luther and Melanchthon in 1530. Now, the closest I can come, and I'm going to give you an early definition of a mystery and then give you the best I can do. I said every time here that what you're getting is one man's response to the experience of the Eastern Orthodox churches, the Eastern non-Orthodox churches, and the writings of those people, both patristic and 19th and 20th century. I'm not saying I'm giving you a 100% accurate view, because as I talk to my Greek and Syrian and Coptic friends, they have different points of view too, just like ALC pastors may have different points of view. But John of Damascus, who was one of the church fathers accepted by many people and wrote some of our very fine hymns in our hymnals, John of Damascus said, "We call it a mystery because what we believe is not the same as what we see." That's really not much of a definition, is it? It tells you what a mystery is, but it's hinting at the fact that what we see, foot washing, bread, wine, incense being twirled around, an icon, isn't really what's there. Isn't really what we believe about it. So we can't say they believe the bread and the wine become or is or remains or symbolizes or whatever. Can't use any of those terms we Westerners use. Whether we're radical Protestants who talk about symbolism, whether we're Lutherans who talk about real presence, or whether we're Catholics who talk about the representation of the sacrifice of Christ or transubstantiation. They don't use any of those terms because it's a mystery. They don't try to define it. Now, I'm going to try to define it for you using some of our terms. I'm going to suggest that a mystery is that which gives sanctifying grace to the family of God. Sanctifying grace is a term they understand. I mentioned Monday, I think it was, that when Melanchthon translated the Augsburg Confession into Greek as a political gambit to get the Eastern Orthodox on their political side against the Roman Catholics in Italy and in Spain and in southern Germany, he didn't talk about justification by faith or justification by grace. He changed it into the Greek words that said sanctified by grace. Melanchthon was no dummy. He knew what he was doing, and that's where I'm picking up the word. That a mystery is anything. You call it a rite if you want to, call it a liturgy if you want to, call it a sacramental if you want to, call it an act if you want to, call it a drama if you want to. It's anything by which the sanctifying grace of God is conveyed to the family of God. Now that's broad, isn't it? But all my reading and all my talking, that's the best I can do for you. Now, with it that broad, the varying number of so-called mysteries in the Eastern Church is phenomenal. You know, I mentioned that we Lutherans have two, and maybe we could sneak into three, or possibly four, if we push Luther to the end of his rope. Catholics have seven. You can get an authority for himself in the Eastern Church from patristic ages, which means 3rd to the 6th century mostly, or in the 19th and 20th century, and they'll vary from saying there are only two to there are 14. And there is one who says there are 31. Now, I'm not going to tell you all 31. I don't even want to bother with all 14. But you see, if it's that broad a statement, a mystery is that which conveys a sanctifying grace to the family of God, your prayer for me becomes a sacrament. Do you follow that definition? My prayer for you, or Ed Schramm's prayer at the beginning of a Bible study, becomes a mystery, not a sacrament. It becomes a mystery. The intercessory prayers some women's groups have, where they list all the missionaries' birthdays or something, it's a mystery. because the grace of God is conveyed not only to the prayer, but to the person for whom they are praying. Follow the definition we're talking about. Because this is vital if you're going to understand this whole business. They never agreed on seven until after the 13th century. Nobody ever talked about seven in the Eastern Orthodox Church. That seven wasn't important at all. Seven got to be a sort of a spiritual thing in the Western Catholic Church instead of the Eastern Church, and they picked it up. Very little numbering of seven comes until even in the 17th century, so that we have a rather peculiar situation going on here. No concept of sacrament as such. It's all a mystery. Sometimes they use another word here, typikon. I just put it up there. That's a Greek word, which means it's almost similar to the word like icon. It's almost an image, a replay, an instant replay on television, football, or basketball. It's a typikon, a replay of the incarnation, a replay of Gethsemane, a replay of the crucifixion, a replay of the foot washing, a replay of the transfiguration, which I emphasized Monday, a replay of the resurrection. That's the kind of thing you could emphasize. So, let me quote one of the 20th century Orthodox theologians, Mayendorf. He says, "No Orthodox council ever defined the number of mysteries." And nobody's done it in modern times either. A mystery is a mystery is a mystery, to paraphrase Gertrude Stein. A rose is a rose is a rose. And a mystery is a mystery or a mystery. A mystery is what God makes it. A mystery is what the Holy Spirit makes it. And this is very significant. Now, I can just give you a few names. For example, John of Damascus, whom I quoted, said there are only two. Only two mysteries. And they were obviously baptism and communion. Dionysius the Apagite, who was about the middle of the 4th century, he said there were six. And Joseph of Ephesus, most of you have heard of Ephesus, Paul wrote a letter there, and it's on the west coast of Turkey right now, he said there were 10. So, you know, if you try to say, as some Lutheran scholars say, we got to go back to the fathers, and they'll help correct us. The fathers are as confused as we are, because it's a mystery. It's not that the fathers can't count. It's the fathers have a different concept of what's going on. Now, I want to say that where we go now is into the Bible, briefly. Let's just first of all say that the power of God, the gift of the Holy Spirit, that's what makes a mystery. The presence of sanctifying grace, that's what makes a mystery. Not the definitions of a council, or a pope, or a Luther, not the actions of a priest, or a pastor, or a lay person, but the act of God being present with his grace. Let me give you another simple sentence. The splendor and the glory and the power of God are made available for us to realize and appropriate in an acted drama that all can enter into equally. We have never fully recognized nor realized the dynamic power available to us through him who dwells within us. That almost sounds like a Pentecostal writing, doesn't it? And yet that's straight out of a Near Eastern theologian. We've never realized the mystery, the dynamism, the power, the glory of God that's available for us through all these mysteries. Now, if you have a Bible, open to chapter 13 of the Gospel of John. There are a few around here. Some of you want to. You don't actually have to have one, but you might enjoy having it in front of me just to check me up. One of the famous New Testament scholars in the United States, Frederick Grant, has written a lot on the book of John, and so has C.H. Dodd, an English scholar, written on John. Frederick Grant, when he opens his discussion of this particular chapter, says this. This is one of the most difficult passages to interpret in the whole New Testament. It is unique. There is nothing comparable to it in the other Gospels. There's nothing comparable to it in the other Gospels. Now, McGregor, who was quoted by Ed Schramm the other day, said, this is really the Eucharist in John. There isn't any Eucharist or Lord's Supper in the Gospel of John. Can't find it. You go pace through it yourself if you don't believe me. It's not there. And yet the Gospel of John, as I said earlier, has the longest discussion, longest prayer, longest description of Jesus and the disciples in the upper room of any of the other three Gospels. Now that seems peculiar, doesn't it? That, you know, I can't make an argument of silence. If you were here at the Bible study with Jim a moment ago, about an hour ago, he said something about the Epistle of John was written about the year 100. Maybe the Gospel of John was written about 104. That's a possibility. There's also the possibility that the Gospel of John was written much earlier than that. But it isn't when the Gospel of John is written. It's how come they left out the Lord's Supper. Now, those who say John is influenced by the Gnostics say they left it out because he spiritualized it into chapter 6 and chapter 13. Those who say he isn't influenced by the Gnostics say he left it out because he's so late. Everybody knew about the Lord's Supper. Paul had written. The other three Gospels were written, so you didn't put it in. That's a rather weak argument to me as to what's going on. But most of us, you see, do what McAfee Brown says. We do with many things. We evade or spiritualize that which makes us uncomfortable or that which we never heard about. So we evade it. And that's why McGregor, and I like him as a Bible student, but he says, just as our altarpiece says, it's an example of humility. And isn't a mystery? Maybe I can make it a mystery. How can a bunch of Westerners become humble? That would be a mystery of the sanctifying grace of God. You know, we think America above all, we've got all the rights and we got to use all the energy we want. And if they won't give us all the energy we got, we'll go over and get it from Sinai and Saudi Arabia, etc. You know, maybe the greatest mystery would be if the United States would turn out to be humble servants. But that gets into Vern Rieke's speech tomorrow on all the kinds of things we're going to do. Now, let's look at this definition of sacraments first, because I'm saying foot washing is the forgotten sacrament, except among Dunkards or Mennonites, Primitive Baptists, Free Will Baptists, and a few others, like the Orthodox. When you're in the Holy Land over Easter, and I've spent two Easters in Holy Land, two Holy Weeks there for the whole time, you can go to about 6 foot washing ceremonies in one day. You know, you really get caught up into it. If you go into a Greek village or into a village of an Eastern church in northern Syria or northern Lebanon, you can go on and have a foot washing ceremony. Ernst Benz, who's I quoted, a Lutheran who talks about the Eastern Orthodox frequently, said the reason foot washing never took in Western Germany, and I like his phrase, it was not adopted as a sacrament, quote, for reasons of propriety. You know, it's like Schramm talking about what are you going to do with those pantyhose? You know, it's a little difficult to have foot washing. When I gave this in Cyprus, one of the Presbyterians said that a friend of his decided to do what I did out here at Holden one time, and he decided since the ladies of the church, the older ladies of the church, were meeting, he didn't tell them what he was going to do on Holy Week. He decided to have a foot washing ceremony. And he suddenly discovered every one of them had pantyhose on. So he was really frustrated. That was a mystery to him as to why that happened. So for acts of propriety, now that's what a Lutheran says in the West. Father Joseph, who's my friend in St. Elias Syrian Orthodox Church in Toledo, says that the reason it isn't carried on in this particular part of the world, meaning Toledo, is simply the United States American culture is such that our people wouldn't do it anymore. And then he puts another one that's a sad one. He says, Holy Week for our businessmen is such a busy opportunity that we don't have enough attendance in Holy Thursday to wash feet. There wouldn't be enough feet to wash. That's a sad commentary. But you note it's a cultural conditioning that they've lost out. Now, back to John 13, which Frederick Grant says is the toughest thing. Quickly, there is a sign and an earthly means. Water, feet, towels, you decide. And in the Orthodox services, there's also the sprinkling of the holy water that people's feet have been washed. Now, you wouldn't call that a mystery. We could never understand the first time we were there, but the second time we could. After everybody's feet had been washed in the Greek Orthodox service in front of the Holy Sepulchre, the water in which the feet had been washed was scattered over the crowd with hyssop, so that everybody got blessed with holy foot water. Now, you know, just your little reaction indicates, again, that's not quite our culture. And the ultimate thing about that was, remember, this is a mystery. You might want to call it a sacrament, as I am, just because it's our language. But when it was all gone from the hyssop, they then threw what little there was left in the bottom of the basin, and then there was a mad rush, mostly by women, but some men and children, with their handkerchiefs to dry up the rest of it. Like the Catholic priest and his acolyte tries to finish all the wine in the cup, they wanted all of that foot washing water, and they took it home with them. It was a mystery of the sanctified grace that was present with them in that ceremony, and they wanted it. Now, Westerners say, oh, that's superstition. That's a value judgment we're making. From their point of view, it is a mystery that's given to us. So, listen to Jesus in verse 4. He rose from supper. Please note it can't possibly be denigrated or demeaned into a foot-washing ceremony that should have been done before the supper. You know, we have several of those where you wash the disciples' feet or you wash other people's feet before you eat, like we wash our hands before we eat or serve the meal. It's not that, because it's during supper. He laid aside his garments, girded himself with a towel, poured water into a basin, and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wash them with the towel with which he was girded. Now, I don't care which one, if you want to use sacramental scenes, but there was something going to happen. You might say towel, water, feet, Jesus' hands, whatever, were involved in the earthly element. But that's not it. What's the spiritual gift? It comes in two places here. Let's quickly remember what Peter does. Peter says, Lord, do you wash my feet? Jesus answered, what I am doing you do not know now, but afterward you will understand. Peter said to him, you'll never wash my feet. Listen to what Jesus said. If I do not wash you, you have no part in me. No part in the Christ? No part in the Messiah who came to fulfill the covenant promises? No part? Listen to what that word really means in other translations. In one translation, the Jerusalem Bible, which is one of my favorite translations, it's translated this way. If I do not wash you, you have nothing in common with me. Wow, that's strong, isn't it? You have nothing in common with me. Literally, it says, you have no share with me. It's the same word that's used in the story of the prodigal son, where the prodigal son says to his father, give me my share. It's the same word that's used in the story of Mary and Martha, which says she has chosen the better share, or she has chosen, as it's translated, the better part frequently. Obviously, to have something in common with Christ is to belong to him, to share his life, to share his fellowship, to be part of him, to be the person who has been accepted into his family, into his communion, into his community. If I do not wash you, you're not one of me, is really a tough way of saying it. By washing of the feet, Jesus makes disciples, including you and me, Dunkards and Eastern Orthodox and Primitive Baptists and hopefully some Lutherans occasionally, makes us part of him. That's a mystery, but it's sanctifying grace. How do I become part of him? We say baptism. We say it's renewed in communion. Luther says it's renewed every morning. We see the beautiful sunshine, and baptism is renewed every morning. They say it's also renewed like this. It's renewed by this. And then Peter, of course, didn't quite understand. Jesus had already said he didn't understand. He said, Lord, don't bother with just my feet. Give me a bath. Wash my head and my hands and all of me. And Jesus said, very simply, he who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet,
But he is clean all over, and you are clean, but not all of you. Now, that's a tricky passage. Any commentator you read in the New Testament on the Gospel of John gets into all kinds of mixtures. Kuhlman, some of you know Kuhlman as a theologian. Kuhlman has two different answers in two different books as to what it means in that particular thing. At one time he says the bath is baptism, the washing is foot washing. Another place he says the bath is baptism, the washing symbolizes communion. He's back into the old hang-up that we got to have the Eucharist or we don't have a share of Christ. One of the reasons you and I as Lutherans or Protestants or Roman Catholics go to the Eucharist is to have the communion. It's communion not only of us in fellowship, it's communion with God, it's communion of the holy things. The communion of bread and wine, body and blood. That communion is there, so we have that. But this isn't all. This isn't all. I've got to skip over to another part of this text to let you know, because it fits so much. Verse 17 says, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Blessed. Gosh, we're back to this word again. A spiritual blessing conveyed by an earthly means that we continually do. Archbishop Makarios, the name Makarios is the word for blessed in Greek. Makarios, and so you have this word blessing right here. If you do it, blessed are you. I want to just say one other thing about this. Calvin on this text, and some of you know Calvin, he was one of Luther's little rivals, especially about Lord's Supper. They had a little debate going on among them about this. And Calvin on the text, you need only wash the feet, says, if the Holy Scripture occupies, see his emphasis on preaching and Bible rather than on sacraments, if the Holy Scripture occupies every part of us, we must no longer have anything to do with the polluters of the world. But now, by that part in which we are carnal, we creep on the ground, or at least fix our feet in the clay, and therefore, to that extent, we are unclean and need to be washed. Again, it's sort of non-sacramental, but it's spiritual. He's trying to say we need something because it's our feet that hit that carnal world. You remember the First John Jim was talking about this morning? He's talking about the world, you know, about how we get along with the world or how we don't get along with the world or how we avoid the world or hate the world. It was very important. Tertullian, which is another one of the ancient church fathers, said the promise of the blessing, if you do it, is the most important part of this mystery. What other sacrament does it say we're blessed in so many words? In the Lord's Supper, it says this, do in remembrance of me. It says this will be the forgiveness of sins. In the baptism, it says do it for the repentance and for the remission of sins. It never puts that final little stamp, you'll be blessed. You'll have a special blessing if you have your feet washed. Now, I'm just going to keep reminding you, before you raise your arches too high, or your back, or your hackles, or whatever you raise normally when you hear this, remember McAfee Brown? We hear what we want to hear in commentators. We listen to what we want to listen. We tolerate, but we evade or spiritualize what makes us uncomfortable. So let's try not to be too uncomfortable with this. Now, the need to be part of him is very similar to what Paul says, not discerning the Lord's body in Corinthians. To be part of him is to be part of his body, right? To be part of the fellowship of the church. And when Paul talks about let a man examine himself, and so let him eat and drink, for if he does not discern the Lord's body, you know, he is not worthy to partake of the elements. Worthy because he didn't see the ecumenical family of God as a worshiping community. Unworthy because he hasn't become a part of the share of this. Know ye is an interesting phrase here that he uses in that particular place. He uses understanding later, but note that. This is an important part. One of my fourth lecture, if I were giving it, is heresy, a matter of head or heart. And note this, he uses two words in Greek, know this, and then he said, later you'll understand. Now we Lutherans go the other way. We try to make people understand the catechism, the confessions, the doctrines, And then we say, come and enjoy. Come and receive. Come and get baptized. Come and get washed. Come and do the other. Jesus says, and also the disciples did it frequently at Pentecost and other places, even for baptism. They instructed after baptism. He's saying here, you'll experience something. You'll experience the sanctifying grace which makes you a part of me. And later on you'll understand what it's all about, maybe. But we put the cart before the horse, to take an old, old cliche. We say, if you don't understand, you better not come. If you're not old enough to understand, or you're too senile to understand, we're going to deny you the sacrament of the altar. Whereas Jesus is saying about foot washing, and I think he would say it about communion, experience my presence first. Experience my share first. Be with me first, and maybe someday you'll understand. Today we see in a glass darkly, but then face to face. Today we share, and we don't know how quite we share. Who knows what the spirit of Holden Village is? Can you put your finger on it and define it? But you can experience, can't you? And when you go down to Chillon, or you go back to Spokane, or I go back to Toledo, I might even try to write the Holden experience up. I might even ask Dave Wee to put it into poetry or something, or his wife to put it, Karen, to put it into poetry. But does that still help us to understand? It's the experience that's important. You must remember that in Hebrew, the word knowledge always meant experiential. It never meant head learning. That's why Adam knew his wife, had sexual intercourse with his wife. He didn't take her dimensions, try to figure out whether she had cross eyes or no cross eyes, or whether her hair was falling out or was longer than it should have been. No, he wasn't trying to understand her as a human being. He was having a sexual experience with her. And when the gospel says Joseph knew not his wife, he was surely acquainted with her. I think he knew what family she came from. He probably knew a lot about her background. But he hadn't experienced her sexually. Now, that's the word that's used here. Experience it. Let's just translate it a different way. I think it's easy to say it that way. He says, very simply, in this passage, if I do not wash you, you have no part in me. Lord, not my hands and my head. He who has bathed does not need to wash except for my feet. And then we get the whole statement about, know what I have done. Blessed are you who do them. It's a rather simple thing. Now, let's move on to the last part. It's not the end of this. The last part in our idea of a sacrament is commanded by Christ. Now, one of the reasons we eliminate some of these is, unless you're going to make the Trinity the important part, and Christ is involved in it, marriage wasn't ordered by Christ, ordination wasn't ordered by Christ or God, confirmation isn't anywhere in the Bible to begin with, so that wasn't commanded by God unless it was through the Pope or some council. Anointing of the sick was commanded by James, and the Lord seemed to suggest it as a possibility, but here it is. He says, do it. If I, the Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you should wash each other's feet. Man, isn't that simple? Why have we evaded it? Why have we spiritualized it? It's as straightforward. I think it's as simple as this do in remembrance of me. It's as simple as that. But he even says it a little more than that. He says, I have given you an example so you may copy what I have done to you. What does the word copy mean? Carbon copies in a paper means you got to do it more than once. If I make a copy of something, whether it's a poem or something else, I do it frequently. You should do as I have done, is the King James. I read you the other translation. King James is even clearer, isn't it? I have given you an example, so you should do as I have done. And then we evade it, spiritualize it, and get uncomfortable. And decide, he didn't mean that. He didn't mean wash each other's feet. He didn't mean have a mystery of the grace of God by sharing Christ's presence. He surely didn't mean that. It was something else. Now, the word that's used here for copy is a rather interesting word. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in it. It's the word hupodigma, which is the word for putting something down, like today we would put, when we're trying to get monuments and writing, we'd put down latex and take a copy of it. We press it down on top of something, and we make a copy. It's like a mold, in another way of saying it. And that's what he says, do exactly as I have. So it comes out exactly the same way. The word do, by the way, I don't want to overlook that, is exactly the same word that's used in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and 1 Corinthians for do this in remembrance of me. It's the same word, same form of the word. So Christ obviously has commanded us to do it. Now, how often do you do it? Well, how often do you want to be blessed? When I first went to Jellaway, Knox County, Ohio, back in 1937, in my first parish, the Dunkards, the Brethren, the Mennonites, whatever term you want to use for them, they did it every week as part of the agape, as part of the thing. And they do not distinguish. Agape, foot washing, and Eucharist or Holy Communion is one act. It's one sacramental rite. They don't try to distinguish it the way we say, well, the agape meal was one of those things they had, and then they dropped out of it because, as Paul says, people got to be too greedy and they ate too much and some of the other people didn't get anything to eat. So it turned out to be a hate feast or a rat race instead of a love feast, and so they eliminated it. But the three things belong together, the washing of the feet, the communion, and the others. Up on my bibliography, one of my former colleagues in the Brethren Seminary out in Illinois, just west of Chicago, Schultz, and my Old Testament colleague out there, Dave Wehan, have written a few things about this. And if you're interested in the Brethren theology about this, it's up here. It's called The Soul of the Symbols. You could call it The Soul of the Sacraments or The Soul of the Mysteries. But because he's coming from the other side of Protestantism, he likes that word symbol. And that brings us to the whole issue of all of the sacraments and all of the mysteries. Let me use a few words before I finish up this, how often shall we do it, and what do we do about it in the Lutheran Church and in the Near East. Very simple. Is it a reenactment? Is that all it is? That's what it is in Rome. That's what the Pope does on Holy Thursday. He just reenacts it as a drama. A reenactment of something that's done once a year to show his humility. He goes out and washes some ordinary people's feet. Now, you know, when you got a pope like the one we have now, he doesn't have to do that to show he's humble. He's got other ways of showing that. But he still will keep on the practice, I'm sure. But that's spiritualized too. That's one thing we can say. Imitation of Christ. Imitation of what he did. That's a little different from reenactment, because then you're going to be doing the thing the way you want it. Is it a liturgy? Is it a sacrament in the sense that it gives you something? And then what about the words representing?
What word?
Representing. Representing or representing. And you know, for years, I used to be able to draw little diagrams and make it so simple between Catholics, Lutherans, and other Protestants about the Lord's Supper. I used to be able to do that real easy. And then one day I saw that the word presence was everywhere. The Catholics were saying the representation of Christ. The Reformed Presbyterians were saying the representation of Christ. And the Lutherans were saying the presence of Christ. And we're spelling it all the same way. If you take real presence of Christ that Lutherans like to push, just take the A-L out and you got re-presence again. Representation, representation. We're really much closer. It's a semantic difficulty that many of us have. But let's go on to how often do you copy it? How often do you do it? Well, it's annual in Rome. It's frequently in the Near East. It was up until about 10 years ago in most rural Mennonite churches, it was weekly. Now in some of them, for the same proprietary reasons that St. Elias pastor and the Lutheran Benz says, the Mennonites only do it once or twice a year. It's sad to say that. But I guess pantyhose and other things did it. Or the fact that they're no longer farmers, they all work in town, so they don't have dirty feet. Or they've lost the symbolism, or they don't want the mystery. or they figure they've got to share of Christ through their agape meal or something of the sort. But anyhow, it's to be done. How often do you do a copy? Well, it was done in every village by every priest. You know, those of us who go to the Holy Land and see it done by so-called patriarchs or bishops in the various Eastern churches, we think it has to be done by a bishop. It doesn't. In the Orthodox Church, any pastor, any priest, even the priest who's only had a high school education and has been ordained, performs the rite of foot washing as a mystery for the people of God so that they can be people of God. Now, how's it done? It includes the sign of the cross in the ceiling with oil on the foot, somewhat up here on the inside, as well as the washing. The oil that's used for the sign of the cross and the oil that's used for all the chrismations, for that baptism that I talked about yesterday, all of that confirmation baptism rite that before infant communion takes place, all of that is consecrated on Holy Thursday by an Eastern bishop. And then it's sent out to all the parishes to be used for all the baptisms when it's necessary or for any other anointings of the sick. In other words, it has been consecrated on Holy Thursday to be used. It's the foot washing oil that becomes the baptismal oil that becomes the death oil. Rather interesting symbolism there, isn't it? You have a share of me by the mystery of the sign of the cross in oil at baptism, at foot washing, or at Holy Thursday Lord's Supper, and at death. You have a part of me everywhere. If you don't have it, you have no part of me. Here you have a part of me. That is a very important part. Now, one of the things I think that has kept us from liking this is the thing that some of us were talking about earlier, and that is the kiss of peace afterwards. In our service, it's a handshake. Sometimes people who've been to Holden can give a Holden hug, and they enjoy it. But the Mexican embrazo of people greeting, the Arabs, even Begin and Sadat when they greet each other, have a little touch. We Westerners like space. We can use a brace. I want a little more elbow room. Dormitory living is a little tough for some of you. You haven't lived dormitories for a while. You know, and the older we get, the more space we seem to think we need. And touch, what do you touch? You touch hands most of the time. Even touching feet, you see. I had a class about 7, 8 years ago on massage that we involved in Texas Lutheran College, you know. And, you know, because not only Texas is conservative, but most of the people in the college were conservative, and a lot of Lutherans are conservative. As far as we got on that course was massaging feet. But it was great. You know, massaging feet was as far as we thought we could go. Oh, a few of us did a little massaging on the back, but that wasn't called massaging. That was sort of just relaxing technique. But part of our Western Puritan culture says, thou shalt not touch. It's as if it's the 11th commandment. Because touch between male and male has all kinds of homosexual overtones. Between male and female has all kinds of sixth commandment overtones. Between female and female has all kinds of lesbian overtones, although they can get away with it more than the rest of us can in Western society. So when I said Monday that one of the things about worship as the family of God is the sense of smell is used as well as the sense of hearing and the sense of talking, the sense of touching is used. And foot washing is a sense of touching again. It has that opportunity to show us something that's special and very important. Now, let me just finish with a couple of quotations that I think are important. When the narrative of foot washing is not accepted as an obvious sacramental doctrine, then there arise many perplexing problems of interpretation. What do we do with it? What do you do with do this, part of me, a blessing, copy it? What do you do with all those words? If foot washing is something that's just to remind us of, you know, be a humble servant of everybody now and then. Like I'm going to be on the dish crew at the double meals today. You know, that'll humble me a little bit. You know, I haven't scrubbed pots for a long time. But is that what this is all about? Om Hal Wolf, instead of being a teacher and a preacher or a retired preacher, you become a pot scrubber? I know Paul says we're all cracked pots in one of his things, but I don't think that's really what this text is about. As you've listened to me now, as I'm gradually closing off, could you really say that this is only a message about humility? Only a message about humility? No part in me? Blessing? Sure, blessed are the humble. And that sort of thing does happen in the Beatitudes, in the other Gospels. I think there's more than that there. You know, why isn't it mentioned in the book of Acts? That's the final part of my thing. Again, you got silence. Because technically, the Lord's Supper isn't mentioned in the book of Acts. They talk about they ate common meals and they broke bread. And we've made an assumption that one of those, at least, must mean communion. What's wrong with making the same assumption and saying one of those must mean an agape meal and a foot washing, and the other one means communion? If we're going to make assumptions, we've got to allow the whole thing to be wide open. They gathered together and ate and had the breaking of bread. Breaking of bread doesn't mention wine. Breaking of bread might mean the agape feast only. It might mean shared fellowship meals, but it could also mean the entire thing, and this is where I close by saying it's simply the three things can't be separated. The agape fellowship meal, a shared family of God in worship, the foot washing of being a part of Christ, and the Holy Communion or Eucharist is sharing his body and his blood for the forgiveness of our sins. And in the totality, blessed are you if you do him. Final story and then a discussion. Some of you have heard the name of Henry Sloane Coffin. Henry Sloane Coffin was a very fine theologian, a very fine preacher, and he went to China before World War II. And he asked a group of Chinese people, non-Christian as well as Christian, this is the question. What was the most impressive thing about Jesus Christ? And the answer was a consensus. Is washing of the disciples' feet. Not the miracles. They had plenty of miracle workers. Not the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. They had plenty of good philosophers. Not people who had sacrificed themselves on crosses. They had plenty of people who'd been martyred. They had plenty of people who died. They had plenty of stories about people coming back, because after all, you've got the karma, and you've got reincarnation, and you've got all of that going on in some of the Eastern non-Christian religions. The impressive thing was that this is how he made his people apart. And the philosopher, the theologian, shared with his people. Now, that's as far as I want to go. We've got a couple of times for, yeah, David?
How important is it that it be the feet that are washed in the view of these churches?
That's
one of the crucial passages in chapter or verse 8 there is that I do not wash you. And it strikes me that was probably in those days about the only accessible part
without disrobing or something of the sort. Right.
Why not the forehead or the hands or the...
There are people who are talking that way, David, and I think I could go that way. The only thing that would hold me up is if the word copy really means copy. So if we copy, we got to have feet. Now, to go you one further, and this is not attempt to be sacrilegious or funny. It'll sound funny to you, so I preface that way. Some people say, what we need to do now is just shine each other's shoes.
Just what?
Just shine each other's shoes at the agape and the communion service, which gets into something you say. Maybe wash each other's face or hands or something of the sort. Personally, I think it would do the same thing for what we think it is, you know, communion and sharing and touching. I'm not sure it would have the same sacramental mystery concept of blessed. We'd be only copying, in a way. I have no real strong feel. Yes, another question.
What I was thinking is, the reason that Christ washed their feet is because they wore sandals. And I've been in Israel, and it's sandy, and their feet become dirty.
I think you missed a very strong part of my speech.
No, I didn't miss that, but one of the reasons...
All right, I'm saying very strongly that the feet had been washed before this happened. That was the normal part that you do before you have the entry. And you remember how often Jesus had people wash his feet. Sometimes they made a mistake. Sure, they washed him because there was none. But this says, during supper, it's very clear, he rose. It doesn't say he did it as an entrance rite, as a cleansing rite, before they got there and ate supper. I wash my hands before I eat. They wash their feet before they eat. That was already done. This says during supper. And it's a very clear statement that this had nothing to do with the hospitality rite that you read in the other Gospels, where Simon forgot to wash Jesus' feet, and then a woman comes and washes feet, and Jesus boils other people. That's a hospitality rite. It's an entrance rite. It's a pre-meal rite. This says it so clearly. During the supper. I think it's very strong. I don't think you can, we can spiritualize it and evade it, which is McAfee Brown's word, by saying they had dirty feet, but their feet were already washed as far as this goes. Yeah. Dan?
The minister's edition of the Lutheran Book of Worship has the order of foot washing on Monday, Thursday. And does that tend to be more of a demonstration or more of a drama?
What I see us doing there is picking up the Western papal custom. I don't think we see it as I see in the death copy, the little brown copy you're talking about. As I see that, I do not see it as being a mystery or a sacrament. It's like the bronze statue. It's an example of our humility, our mutual shared servanthood, I guess I could say. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just isn't quite enough.
Another point, the major objection I've shared in foot washing, but the major objection I've heard is it's repulsive.
Right.
A normal answer to that, that's exactly the point.
Yeah, that's a good answer. You know, Ben says it was not done for reasons of propriety. But, you know, there are a lot of people who think giving people wine out of a common cup is offensive. So if you're going to stop things because it's offensive, you're going to get in trouble. Because then you'll stop the kiss of peace, you'll stop the pox, you'll stop the getting up and down 150 times in the same service, because that's offensive to some of us with arthritis. You know, there are all kinds of things that we can get offensive about. And Lutherans are good at getting offensive. And the sharing of the person's needs is there too.
It can be a very erotic part of your
life. Of course it can.
And I think there are a whole lot of elements involved in washing somebody that could be seen to that would not have been to wash somebody's hands.
Right, because we're used to touching hands.
Right.
It's a different thing. And if you use the oil in addition, that's even more erotic, even though we get more offended and worried about what's going on there if we use the oil afterwards. Yeah?
I have two questions. One is, you spoke of Sloan Coffin, you said was. Is he dead? You kept saying, well, I didn't think he died yet.
No.
Is he not dead? Okay, I'm sorry. I thought he was. Thank you for checking me out on that.
Well, we haven't heard of him for a long time. He may be dead, but...
I thought he was, but I have no...
My other question is, you keep referring to the agape and the communion service together. Do they not ever separate them in the Orthodox Eastern Church?
Yes, they do, but they... in the Orthodox Church, they are separated, but the bread for the poor is sort of a remnant of that. At the end.
Because we at our church have small groups, and we sometimes have an agape feast when the clergy is not present. It's another thing we're hung up on.
Yeah, we Lutherans are hung up about sacramental presence, aren't we, rather than real presence.
So we have an agape feast.
Yeah.
What form is that?
What agape feasts normally are in places where I've been in Ohio, that's how to have communion without breaking the Lutheran standards.
Yeah. And what is that form? What is it?
Well, it varies from place to place. Many people have a small meal. Some of them merely have the breaking of bread and the sharing of the cup, which without the pastor's presence, that's sometimes.
Some have a potluck.
Some have the potluck with it. Yeah.
Two questions. In my parish, we have foot washing, but if the pastor wants to have his feet washed, I mean, is there some guideline with that? Can you have an assistant wash your feet? Or?
I think that's the way it should be done, the same as we do for communion.
Okay.
You know.
And then would you have the foot washing? Say I'm wanting to finish the service before the Holy Communion, during the Holy Communion, or after the Holy Communion?
Okay. Now the problem. That's a good question. The problem with John is, you see, there's no Holy Communion mentioned, so it's during supper. My feeling is that it should be agape supper if you're going to have one, brief liturgy if you're going to have one, foot washing liturgy, then communion. That would be my order, but you know, that's just, you know, I've been saying all week, I'm one man's opinion. I'm not speaking for the Lutheran Church or for the Orthodox Church, but that's where I would come down. Yeah.
Who washes the people's feet always?
Yes.
The people don't wash each
other's. No, they don't.
Because I should think the benefit would come more from the one who's doing the washing.
That's right. And one of the things we did, and I've forgotten, there are various myths about how long ago this first foot washing ceremony took place at Holden that I started, but there we had everybody washing everybody's feet. There was a difference there. We each took somebody. It wasn't a matter of priests doing it or pastors doing it. It was people doing it for people. And we really felt we had a share. That word, a share in them or a part of me, was really there. David?
How do these churches justify having just the clergymen doing the washing?
They do it exactly the same way we justify it, only clergymen have communion.
And how do we justify that?
You know how we do it? Because we're still Western priestly oriented in spite of the fact that we say we believe in the priesthood of all believers. I am I'll say it publicly, I really am a nonconformist Lutheran. And I do not believe that Jesus intended, since ordination is not a biblical thing, I don't believe he set me aside with some kind of special power, like the Catholic priest is supposed to have special power, to have this thing. The only reason I go along with it is that I still believe that things have to be done decently and in order. And until the Lutheran Church maybe decides to do it another way, especially now I'm not going to upset the apple cart more than I've done in the past 40 years. One more comment, and then one over here, and then we'll close.
It seems to me like that it's not necessarily all that biblical. Like, some of the rites that we consider necessary for priests to do, do not necessarily end them. The ordination is true. And Jesus sent for John to do that, but he sent that kind of thing to else.
Right.
And I think that's true. He sent his disciples up to do all these things that we now need to do, that we could ourselves do as well, because I think it's easier.
It's a delegated congregational authority. If we're Lutherans, we're really saying it isn't the pastor. He has been, by decency and in order, delegated to be the representative of the congregation to do that. That's if we start getting dogmatic about it. Because I don't have any special powers conferred on me by ordination, the way the Catholic and Episcopalians and Eastern Orthodox might say. One last question, then we'll close.
Well, this isn't a question.
All right,
but
make a statement.
We had an interesting experience of getting in on the Seventh-day Adventist foot washing. And it was really very touching. But their idea, at least this, it was before their communion, and they put it that if somebody had something that, you know, for instance, if I had done something to you and I wanted forgiveness, this is the way they use their foot washing.
As a rite of confession.
As a rite of mm-hmm. confession, you might say. And it was held in a separate room before they went to mm-hmm. communion.
Thanks. They separate the men
and the
women, don't they?
Oh, yes, for the foot washing, yes, separate rooms.
Right. Uh-huh. Thanks for sharing that. Tomorrow, Vern Reeke and I are going to share this hour on law and or gospel. Mm-hmm.